He would be caught red-handed, with no defense and no excuse. And the Emperor would make him pay dearly. Why should we find it odd or difficult to believe that disturbances at the pinnacle of government are transmitted to the lowliest levels of society? Cynical, brutal hunger for power cannot be concealed. Camar Pilru, Ixion Ambassador in Exile, Speech to the Landsraad. On Ix, even after their numbers had been more than halved, the Sardaukar fought on. Oblivious to pain or grievous wounds, the drug-frenzied imperial fighters showed no fear for their own lives. One of the uniformed Sardaukar drove a young Atreides fighter to the ground, reached a gloved hand through his shield, and switched off the controls. Then, like a de-wolf, he bared his teeth and ripped out the man's throat. Duncan Idaho could not understand why the Emperor's elite corps would so ferociously defend the Tleilaxu. Clearly, young Commander Kando Garon would never surrender, not even if he were the last man alive atop a mountain of dead comrades. Duncan reassessed his strategy, focusing on the goal of his mission. While projectile fire spattered around him like sparks from a bonfire, he raised a hand and bellowed in Atreides' battle language, "To the Grand Palais!" The Duke's men disengaged from the maddened Sardaukar and pushed around them, forming a phalanx with Duncan at the lead. He carried the old Duke's sword and slashed at any enemy who came within reach. Boots slapping on stone, they raced through the ceiling tunnels, negotiating honeycombed passageways toward the stalactite administrative buildings. A lone, defiant Sardaukar soldier, his uniform torn and bloodied, stood in the middle of a skyway bridge that spanned the open grotto. When he saw Duncan's men charging toward him, he clasped a grenade to his chest and detonated it, blowing up the bridge. His body tumbled through the enclosed sky, along with a rain of fire and structural wreckage. Appalled, Duncan signaled for his men to back away from the severed bridge, while he looked for another route to the inverted pyramid of the Ixion Palace. How do we fight against men like this? Trying to spot a new aerial walkway, he watched as a transport barge crashed into one of the Grand Palais balconies, obviously driven by a madman. Rebels surged off the platform and into the royal structure, shouting defiance. Duncan led his men over a second bridge and finally entered the upper levels of the Grand Palais. Tleilaxu bureaucrats and scientists fled for shelter, wailing and pleading for mercy in Imperial Gallic. A few Atreides soldiers took potshots at the unshielded forms, but Duncan called his men together. "Don't waste your efforts. We can clean up the garbage later." They ran ahead through the once grand but now Spartan rooms. Atreides fighters had spread into the crustal levels of the city, and some had taken lift tubes down to the cavern floor, where fierce fighting continued. Battle cries and screams echoed through the cavern, mixing in the air with the stomach-twisting stench of death. Duncan's squad reached the main reception chamber and marched onto an inlaid checkerboard floor. There, they encountered a surprising confrontation between ragtag passengers from the crashed cargo barge and furious Sardaukar guards. Broken crystal plaths and sinstone wreckage lay strewn around the grounded barge in the middle of the reception floor. At the center of it all, he saw Romber's unmistakable cyborg form, along with the troubadour Gurney Halleck, both men struggling to hold their own. Gurney's fighting style had no finesse, nothing that would have impressed the swordmasters of Ginaz. But the former smuggler had an instinctive prowess with a weapon. When Duncan's men rushed forward, howling the names of Duke Leto and Prince Romber, the desperate battle turned in their favor. Suboids and Ixion citizens fought with renewed strength. A side passage burst open, and several blood-spattered Sardaukar ran forward, firing weapons and shouting. Their hair was in disarray, and their faces streaked with scarlet, but they kept coming. Commander Kando Garon led them in a suicide attack. Through the bloodlust, Garon noticed the cyborg prince and charged directly at him with blind fury. In each hand, the commander carried a sharp blade, already slicked with thick crimson fluid. Duncan recognized the son of the Emperor's Supreme Bashar, saw murder in his eyes, and launched himself into motion. Years ago, he had failed to stop the attack of the frenzied Seleucid bull that had killed old Duke Paulus, and he had sworn not to let himself fail again. Romber stood beside the crashed barge, directing the freedom fighters, and didn't see Garon rushing toward him. Rebels streamed off the barge platform, picking their way over the rubble, grabbing weapons dropped by fallen Sardaukar. Behind Romber, the blasted open wall of the Grand Palais was a yawning hole that overlooked the city grotto. Running at full speed, Duncan crashed into Garon, striking him on the side. Their body shields collided with a report like a thunderclap and a momentum exchange that hurled Duncan backward. But the impact also diverted Garon, who staggered toward the gaping hole in the window wall, slipping on debris on the floor. Deflected from his target, the ravening Sardaukar commander saw a chance to kill more of the enemy and collided with three shouting Ixion rebels who stood too close to the edge of the smashed balcony. He spread his strong arms and, like a bulldozer, swept the astonished victims over the precipice. Garon went over the side too, but he managed to grab a broken, protruding girder that had once separated broad sheets of crystal plaz. He caught himself and dangled, his face pulled into a rictus of ferocious effort, his lips skinned back from his teeth. The tendons in his neck stood out like cords ready to snap. He held on with one hand, as if sheer defiance could counteract the relentless pull of gravity. Seeing the leader of the Sardaukar, and knowing Garon was the son of Shaddam's Supreme Bashar, Romber bounded over to the brink on his cyborg legs. He bent down, grasping the broken wall for support, and reached down with his prosthetic mechanical arm. Garon merely snarled up at the proffered assistance. "Take it," Romber said. "I can pull you to safety, and then you must surrender your troops. Ix is mine." The Sardaukar commander made no move to grab his hand. "I would rather die than be rescued by you. My shame would be a far worse death, and facing my father in disgrace would be greater pain than you could imagine." The cyborg prince anchored himself with his legs and reached down to grab Kando Garon by the wrist, squeezing a vice-like hold. He remembered losing his entire family and his own body in flames during the Skyclipper explosion. "There is no pain I cannot imagine, Commander." He began to haul the struggling man up, despite his protestations. But the Sardaukar used his free hand to grab at his own waist and drew a razor knife. "Why don't you let yourself fall with me and we'll die together?" Garon smiled wickedly, then slashed with the thrumming blade. It struck sparks off of Romber's mechanical wrist tendons, hitting the metallic synthetic bone cylinders, but could not cut deeply enough. Undaunted, Romber lifted the young officer close to the edge, where he could be saved. Duncan rushed forward to help. His face insane with determination, Kando Garon slashed again with the powerful cutting tool, this time cutting cleanly through Romber's pulleys and support joints, severing the cyborg hand. As Romber reeled backward, looking at the sparking and smoking stump of his artificial arm, the Sardaukar commander tumbled away without a scream, without so much as a whisper. Rapidly, the remaining Atreides forces and the enthusiastic rebels secured the Grand Palais. Duncan breathed a sigh of relief, but remained wary. After witnessing Kando Garon's suicidal plunge, the Suboids and rebels delighted in throwing captured Tleilaxu over the brink. a grim reflection of the days when the hated overlords had so ruthlessly executed alleged resistors. Catching his breath, Duncan shook with exhaustion. The battles continued below, but he took a moment to greet his companion. "Well met, Gurney." The lumpy-faced man shook his head. "A rather messy meeting, if you ask me." He swiped sweat from his brow. Too weary and ragged to celebrate the long-awaited victory, Kater Pilru sat on a lump of broken plazstone and touched the checkerboard floor, as if trying to recapture childhood memories. "I wish my brother could be here." Recalling the last time he had stood inside the Grand Palais, the son of a respected ambassador, he wished for the stolen years back. It had been a time of elegance and finery, of grand receptions, and of flirtations and intrigues for the hand of Kylie Avernius. "Your father still lives," Romber said. "I would be most pleased to have him restored to service as a respected ambassador for House Vernius." Gently, with precise control of his intact cyborg hand, he squeezed Kater's sagging shoulders. The prince looked at his still-glowing stump, as if dismayed that he would have to be repaired and face rehabilitation again. But Tesha would help him. He couldn't wait to see her once more. Haggard but grinning, Kater looked up. "First, we must find the sky controls so that you can make an announcement and put your final mark on this day." Breaking into the Tleilaxu-controlled palace, he had done the same thing many years before, transmitting sky images of Romber's defiant words. Now he led the way with the prince, Duncan, and a dozen men accompanying them. Outside the control room, they discovered two Tleilaxu dead on the floor, their throats cut. Romber did not know how to operate the equipment, so Kater helped him scan his face into the system. Moments later, they projected the prince's giant image from the grotto ceiling. His amplified voice boomed out. "I am Prince Romber Vernius. I now hold the Grand Palais, my ancestral home, my rightful home. Here I intend to stay. Ixians, throw off your shackles. Subdue your oppressors. Take back your freedom." When he finished, Romber heard a roar of renewed cheers from below, while the battle continued to rage. Gurney Halleck met him in a hallway. "Look what we found." He led the prince to an immense armored storage room, which the Atreides had cut open with lasguns. "We had hoped to root out incriminating records, but instead we discovered this." Cases were stacked from floor to ceiling. One had been pried open to reveal an orange-brown powder, a dusty substance that reeked of cinnamon. "It looks and tastes like melange, but look at the label. It says Amal in the Tleilaxu alphabet." Romber glanced from Duncan to Gurney. "Where did they get so much spice, and why are they hoarding it?" In a low voice, Kater murmured, "I have already seen what occurs in the research pavilion." He looked haggard. Realizing that the others had not heard him, he repeated it, louder, then added, "Now it begins to make sense. Miral and Christine, and the spice odors." His companions looked at him quizzically. Kater's eyes and the slump of his body showed the effects of the years on him. Men of less determination would have given up long ago. He shook his head vigorously, as if to clear a buzzing from his ears. The Tleilaxu were using Ixian laboratories to attempt to create some form of synthetic melange. Amal! Duncan glowered. "This scheme is more than just Tleilaxu villainy. Its shadow extends all the way to the Golden Lion Throne. House Carino has been behind the suffering of all Ixians and the destruction of House Vernius." "Artificial spice." Romber considered this, and it made him angry. "Ix was destroyed? My family murdered? For that?" He recoiled at the very idea, realizing the vast economic and political implications. Scratching his ink-vine scar, Gurney Halleck frowned. Demers said something about tainted spice in his tank. Was this what killed him? Voice throbbing with excitement, Gutierre said, I suspect the answers are in the research pavilion. A man cannot drink from a mirage, but he can drown in it. Fremen Wisdom. After assessing the reconnaissance information obtained by He'i Resser's scout ship, the joint Harkonnen-Mauritani assault force descended into the skies of Caladan. Beast Raban was surrounded by firepower, but he still felt nervous. He flew his own ship at the vanguard of the cobbled-together fleet, ostensibly leading the charge, though he wisely hung close to the heavy assault vessel piloted by the Grumman swordmaster Resser. Viscount Mauritani commanded the foremost troop carrier, ready to secure Caladan from the ground, terrorize the villagers, and lock down control of the Atreides cities. They intended to stop Duke Leto from ever setting foot on the planet again. As he flew down through the clouds, ready for the adrenaline rush of destruction, Raban wondered how House Harkonnen and House Mauritani would divide the spoils of this conquest for joint occupation. His barrel stomach twisted with a knot of queasiness. The Baron would have demanded the lion's share of benefits from this operation. Raban grasped the controls of his attack ship with sweaty fingers, remembering when he had secretly fired upon the two Tleilaxu transports within a highliner hold, attempting a too subtle blow against the untrained young Duke Leto Atreides. Personally, Raban preferred to be more overt than that. If Caladan was truly as exposed as Resser's scout ship suggested, then this whole operation would be over within an hour. The Harkonnen heir couldn't believe Duke Atreides would have made such an error in judgment, even for only a few days. But his uncle had often said that a good leader must constantly remain on the lookout for mistakes and be prepared to exploit them at a moment's notice. The attackers would take control of the castle and city, as well as the spaceport and adjacent military base. By maintaining their hold on a few key places, the Grumman Harkonnen forces could quickly secure their conquest, and then prepare to ambush any Atreides forces returning home. In addition, Gedi Prime and Grumman were prepared to send full-scale reinforcements once this preliminary operation was completed. But Raban worried about long-term political repercussions. A Landsraad protest by Duke Leto might be followed by joint military operations and/or sanctions and embargoes. It could be a dicey situation, and Raban hoped he hadn't made another bad decision. En route, before they had launched their forces, Andro Mauritani had sat on the command bridge of his troop carrier, dismissing the concerns. The Duke doesn't even have an heir. If our position here is secure, who other than the Atreides would risk challenging us? Who would bother? Raban detected the ragged edge of madness in the Viscount's tone, and in the fiery glimmer behind his eyes. Swordmaster Resser broke in over the comm channel. All ships are prepared to proceed with the attack. It is your lead, Lord Raban. Drawing a deep breath of the cockpit's reprocessed air, Raban dropped through the blanket of mist. The ships followed him like a stampede of deadly animals, ready to trample anything that got in their way. "We have the coordinates for Cala City," Resser said. "It should be appearing in front of us momentarily." "Damn this cloud cover!" Raban leaned forward to squint through the cockpit window. When the obscuring mist finally cleared, he could see the bay and the ocean, the rocky cliffs holding tall Castle Caladan, and the large city, spaceport, and military base beyond. Then cries of surprise and confusion erupted across the comm channels. Below, in the ocean surrounding Cala City, Raban saw dozens, no, hundreds of battleships on the water, and floating defensive platforms that moved across the waves in a mobile fortress. It's a gigantic fleet! Those ships were not there yesterday, Swordmaster Resser said. They must have been moved in overnight to defend the castle. But on the water? The Viscount could not believe what he was seeing. Why would Leto disperse such important firepower on the water? That hasn't been done for centuries. This is a trap, Raban cried. Just then, Thufir Hawat called in every single warship that had accompanied his escort of relief carriers to Beakal. The armed air and space vessels zoomed over the castle parapets, then split up and circled around, performing aerial maneuvers in an intimidating show of strength. Dozens of hangar doors in the military base slowly opened, implying that many more attack craft had not yet been launched. "Leto Atreides lured us here," Raban pounded the control panel. "He wants to crush us and subject our houses to Lanzrad punishment." Cursing the Viscount for talking him into this ill-advised assault, Raban yanked his controls and sent his vanguard vessel streaking back into the clouds. Over the comm channel, he gave orders for all Harkonnen vessels to break off the attack. "Retreat! Now, before our ships are identified!" From his command bridge, Viscount Moritani shouted orders that the Grumman soldiers should strike anyway. But in the lead, E.E. Resser concurred with Raban. Choosing not to hear the orders of the Viscount, he issued instructions for his ships to pull out and rendezvous in orbit. Below, the floating fortresses on the water and the highly maneuverable battleships began to raise big guns toward the targets in the sky. It seemed obvious that alarms had been sounded, that the defensive forces were ready to retaliate. Raban flew faster, praying that he could get out of this situation before he caused further humiliation and damage to House Harkonnen. The last time he had made such a mistake, the Baron had exiled him to miserable Lankavile for a full year. He didn't want to imagine what his punishment would be this time. The fleet would reconvene on the dark side of the planet and then head out of the system, hoping that they could meet with the next inbound Highliner. Raban knew that was the only way he could save his own skin. Standing out on the rocky point by the lighthouse statues, Thufir Hawat directed the maneuvers from a portable comm console. He instructed his few airships to make another aggressive overflight for good measure. But the disguised attackers were already on the run, surprised and embarrassed. He wondered who they were. None of the enemy ships had been hit, so no wreckage had been left behind. It would have been preferable to defeat them in a military engagement and take evidence, but he had done everything possible under nearly impossible circumstances. From history, Thufir knew this tactic had been used during the Butlerian Jihad and before. Such a trick could not be used often, perhaps not again in the near future, but it had served its purpose for now. He looked up at the clouds and watched the last of the would-be invaders disappear. They probably assumed Atreides' forces intended to pursue them, but the Mentat didn't dare leave Caladan undefended again. The next day, after receiving confirmation that the intruders had boarded a Highliner and left the system for good, Thufir Hawat called in the scattered fishing boats in the waters around the castle. He thanked the captains for their service, and instructed them to return all holo generators to the Atreides armories before resuming their fishing runs. It is not easy for some men to know they have done evil, for reasoning and honor are often clouded by pride. Lady Jessica, Journal Entry. As he fled through the Imperial Palace carrying the kidnapped baby, Peter de Vries made decisions based on instinct and split-second assessments. Mentat decisions. He did not regret taking advantage of a brief and unexpected opportunity, but he wished he could have planned an actual escape route. The infant squirmed in his hands, but he tightened his grip. If De Vries could make it out of the palace, the Baron would be so pleased. After bounding down a steep service stairway, the interim Harkonnen ambassador kicked open a door and lunged into a narrow alabaster-arched hallway. He paused to recall his mental map of the labyrinthine palace, determining where he was. Thus far, he had taken random turns and passages in order to be unpredictable, and to avoid curious courtiers and palace guards. After an instant of introspection, he recognized that this corridor led toward the study and playrooms used by the emperor's daughters. De Vries stuffed a corner of the blanket into the infant's mouth to suppress its crying, then reconsidered as the baby began to thrash and choke. When he removed the cloth, the child wailed even louder than before. He sprinted through the structural nucleus of the palace, his feet whispering across the floor. Closer to the princess's quarters, the walls and ceiling were of pitted crimson rock imported from Seleucus Secundus. The simple architecture and lack of adornment stood in stark contrast with the opulent sections of the sprawling residence. Though they were imperial offspring, Shaddam lavished few fineries on his unwanted daughters, and his wife Anirul seemed to be raising them in Bene Gesserit austerity. A series of plaz windows lined the hallway on both sides, and the Mentat glanced into each room as he ran past. This Atreides brat counted for little. If the situation took a dramatic downturn, he might need a Carino daughter hostage instead to improve his bargaining position. Or would the emperor even care? During his months of careful observation and planning, De Vries had set up two separate hiding places in the imperial office complex, accessible through tunnels and passageways that linked it with the palace. His ambassadorial credentials granted him the access he needed. Run faster. He knew ways of contacting ground car drivers and thought he might reach the spaceport, even under alarms and crackdowns. But something had to be done to quiet this child. Rounding a turn, he nearly bumped into a boyish-faced Sardaukar soldier, who obviously thought the uniformed De Vries was another guard. "Hey, what's the matter with the baby?" Then a voice crackled in his comm ear. Trying to distract him from the transmission, De Vries said, "Trouble upstairs, just getting him to safety. I guess we're babysitters now." With his left hand, he shoved the wrapped infant into the other man's face. "Here, take him." When the surprised soldier faltered, De Vries used his other hand to slam a dagger into his exposed side. Without bothering to make certain the soldier was dead, De Vries ran on with the baby in one arm and the dagger in his free hand. He realized belatedly that he was leaving too much of a trail behind. Just ahead, he saw a flash of blonde hair. Someone had looked out of a room and ducked back inside, behind the hall windows. One of Shaddam's daughters? A witness? He sidestepped to the room, ducked inside, but didn't see her. The girl must be hiding behind furniture or under the film book-strewn desk. Some toys that belonged to little Chalice were scattered about, but the nursemaid must have taken the child away. Still, he sensed a presence. Someone was hiding. The oldest daughter? Irulan? She might have seen him murder the guard, and he could not allow her to notify anyone. His disguise would keep her from identifying him later, but that wouldn't help if he was caught with the brat in his hands, scarlet stains on his uniform, blood on his knife blade. Warily, he strode deeper into the chamber, his muscles coiled. He noticed a doorway on the opposite wall, slightly ajar. "Come out and play, Irulan!" At a noise behind him, he whirled. The emperor's wife moved with uncharacteristic awkwardness, not the smooth, gliding manner so typical of the witches. She did not look well. Anirul saw the baby and recognized it as Jessica's newborn son. Then startled realization flashed across her face as she noticed the Mentat's smudged makeup, the two red lips. "I know you." She detected murder in the disguised man's eyes. a willingness to do anything. All the voices within shouted warnings simultaneously. Anirul grimaced in pain and grabbed her temples. Seeing her falter, De Vries lashed out with the dagger, as swiftly as a venomous serpent. Though fogged by the clamor tormenting her, the Kwisatz mother went into a blur of motion, darting to one side with suddenly restored Bene Gesserit grace and lethal fighting skills. Her speed surprised him, and De Vries was thrown off balance for just an instant. His knife failed to connect with flesh. From within her sleeve, Anirul removed a favored weapon of the sisterhood and grabbed De Vries by his sinewy neck. She held a poison gum jabar at his throat, the silver needle tip glittering with poison. "You know what this is, Mentat. Surrender the child or die." "What's being done to find my son?" Duke Leto stood beside Chamberlain Redondo, looking at the carnage inside the birthing room. Redondo's high forehead glistened with perspiration. "There will be an investigation, of course. All suspects will be interviewed." "Interviewed? You make it sound so polite." The two medical sisters lay butchered on the floor. Closer to the door, a Sardaukar had been stabbed to death. Nearby, Jessica had struggled groggily on the birthing bed. So close. The assassin could have killed her, too. He raised his voice. "I am talking about now, sir. Has the palace been sealed off? My son's life is at stake." "I assume the palace guard is taking care of all security matters." Redondo tried to sound placating. "I suggest we leave it in the hands of professionals."
"You assume? Who is in charge here?"
"The Emperor is not currently present to command the Sardaukar, Duke Leto. Certain lines of authority must be..." Leto stormed out into the corridor, where he spotted the Levenbrek. "Have you sealed off the palace and all surrounding buildings?"
"We are handling the matter, sir. Please do not interfere."
"Interfere?"
Leto's gray eyes flashed.
"An attack has been made upon my son and his mother."
He looked at the security name tag on the officer's lapel. "Levenbrek Stivs, under the Emergency Powers Act, I am assuming command of the palace guard. Do you understand?"
"No, my lord, I do not."
The officer rested his hand on a stun baton at his waist.
"You have no authority to..."
"If you draw that weapon against me, you are a dead man, Stivs. I am a Duke of the Landsrad and blood cousin of Emperor Shaddam Karino IV. You have no right to countermand my orders, especially not in this matter."
His features hardened, and he felt the hot flow of blood in his arteries.
The officer hesitated, looked over the angry Duke's shoulder at Redondo. "The kidnapping of my son on palace property is an attack against House Atreides, and I demand my rights under the Landsrad Charter. This is an emergency military situation, and in the absence of the Emperor and his Supreme Bashar, my authority exceeds any man's." Chamberlain Redondo took a moment to think.
"Duke Atreides is correct. Do as he says."
The Sardaukar guards seemed impressed by the Atreides nobleman and his quick, firm grasp of command. Stivs barked into a comm unit on his lapel. "Seal off the palace, all surrounding buildings, and the commons. Begin a thorough search for the person who has kidnapped the newborn son of Duke Leto Atreides. During this crisis, the Duke is temporarily in charge of the palace guard. Follow his orders." With a quick motion, Leto removed the officer's comm unit and secured it to the lapel of his own red uniform. "Get yourself another one." Breathing hard, he pointed down the corridor. "Stivs, take half of these men and search the north section of this level. The rest of you come with me." Leto accepted a stun baton, but kept one hand on the jeweled hilt of the ceremonial dagger the Emperor had given him years earlier. If his son had been harmed in any way, a mere stun baton would not be sufficient. With Anirul's gum jabar pressed against his throat, Peter De Vries froze in place. Just a prick, a tiny scratch, and the poison would kill him instantly. Anirul's hands trembled too much for the Mentat's comfort.
"I cannot defeat you," he said in the barest of whispers.
careful not to move his larynx. His fingers loosened their hold on the blanket-wrapped child. Would that be enough to divert her attention? Make her hesitate for just an instant? In his other hand, he held the bloodied dagger. Anirul tried to separate her own thoughts from the ever-increasing clamor within. While four of her daughters were too young to understand, the eldest, Irulan, had watched her mother's physical and mental degeneration. She was sorry that Irulan had to see that, wished she could have spent more time with her daughter, raising her to be a prime Bene Gesserit. Knowing a murderer was loose in the palace, the emperor's wife had come to the study and playrooms to make certain her children were safe. It had been the brave, impulsive act of a mother. The Mentat flinched, and she pushed harder with the needle, attuned to his every impulse. A diamond of perspiration glistened on his forehead and rolled slowly down his powdered temple. The little tableau seemed to last forever. The baby squirmed in his arms. Even though this was not the infant the sisterhood had anticipated for their all-important plans, it was still a link to a web more complex than even Anirul could comprehend. As the Kwisatz mother, her life had been focused on bringing about the final steps in the breeding program, first arranging for the birth of Jessica herself, and then her baby. The genetic linkages had become increasingly pure after millennia of refinement. But in human birth, even with the powers and talents of Bene Gesserit breeding mothers, nothing could be guaranteed. Odds and percentages prevailed, never certainty. After 10,000 years, was it possible to be accurate to within a single generation? Could this baby be the one? She looked into the child's alert, intelligent eyes. Even so newly born, the little fellow had a presence about him, a steadiness in how he held his head. She felt a stirring inside her mind, a rumbling, unintelligible cacophony. "Are you the one, the Kwisatz Haderach? Have you arrived a generation early?" "Perhaps we should discuss this," DeVries said, barely moving his mouth. "An impasse serves neither of us. Perhaps I should waste no more time and just kill you." The voices kept trying to tell her something, to warn her. But in the turmoil, she couldn't understand. What if she had been sent to these rooms in the palace, not to check on her own daughters, but to save this special child? She heard a babble of voices like an oncoming tsunami, and remembered her intense dream of a worm fleeing across the desert from a silent pursuer. But the pursuer was no longer quiet. It was a multitude. A clear voice broke through the cacophony. Old Lobia, with her wry, all-knowing voice, speaking in a soothing tone. Anirul saw the words coming from the kidnapper's sappho-stained mouth, a wavering reflection in the window plaz fronting the hallway. "You will join us soon." Her moment of shock caused her to jerk back. The Gomjabar slipped from her grasp and tumbled toward the floor. Inside her head, Lobia's voice screamed out a desperate warning, breaking through the background noise. "Beware the Mentat!" Before the silver needle could even strike the tiles, DeVries had already brought the dagger up in a blur, slicing through black robes and deep into her flesh. As the first gasp exploded from Anirul's mouth, he struck again, and a third time, like a heat-maddened viper. The Gomjabar hit the floor with a sound like shattering crystal. Now the voices roared around Anirul, louder and clearer, drowning out the pain. "The child has been born, the future changed. We see a fragment of the plan, a tile of the mosaic. Understand this, the Bene Gesserit plan is not the only one. Wheels within wheels, within wheels, within wheels." Lobia's voice sounded louder than all the rest, more comforting. "Come with us, observe more, observe it all." Lady Anirul Corino's dying lips trembled with what might have been a smile. And she knew suddenly that this one child would reshape the galaxy after all. and changed the course of humanity more than the hoped-for Kwisatz Haderach ever could. She felt herself falling to the floor. Anirul could not see through the mists of her approaching death, but she understood one thing with absolute certainty. The sisterhood will endure. Even as the Kwisatz mother collapsed beside her poison needle, De Vries was running back out into the hallway with the hostage baby. They slipped through a side passageway. "You'd better be worth all this trouble," he muttered to the rapt infant. Now that he had killed the Emperor's wife, Peter De Vries wondered if he would ever get out of the palace alive. All proofs inevitably lead to propositions that have no proof. All things are known because we want to believe in them. Bene Gesserit, Ajar Book. Aboard his orbiting flagship, Emperor Shaddam Corino had no intention of returning to Kaitain while the audit of Harkonnen spice operations on Arrakis continued. And once Choam declared the Baron guilty, he had something else in mind, something drastic. This was his window of opportunity, and he could not ignore it. From his private cabin, Shaddam watched events unfold exactly as he had hoped. Though he wore a military uniform, his opulent imperial quarters were filled with amenities unfamiliar to the austere Sardaukar. Sealed behind the opaque cabin doors, he summoned the Supreme Bashar to join him for a gourmet meal, ostensibly to discuss strategy. But in truth, the Emperor just liked to hear war stories about the old soldiers' military campaigns. In Zum Garon's early years, he had been a training prisoner on Seleucia Secundus, a slave picked up during a raid on a distant planet. Though poorly armed and untrained, Garon had shown so much bravery and fighting skill that the Sardaukar had drafted him into their ranks. The man was quite a success story, and his son Kando seemed to be following in the old veteran's footsteps, commanding the secret legions stationed on Ix. Relaxing for a moment after the meal, Shaddam looked across the table at Garon's craggy face. The Supreme Bashar had eaten only sparingly of the exotic dishes and had been a disappointing dinner companion. Garon seemed preoccupied with the siege of Arrakis. The cluster of guild ships continued to lock down all activity on the deserts below, and Shaddam waited with the eagerness of a malicious gossip to learn what embarrassing errors and cover-ups the inspectors had found. In this matter, Choam and the Spacing Guild were convinced they were the Emperor's allies, integral parts of a crackdown on House Harkonnen. The Emperor could only hope he'd be able to eradicate the only natural source of melange before they suspected the truth. Then they would have to come to him for Amal. When a shuttle bearing the Guild Legate and the Choam Mentat Auditor arrived from Karthag, Sardaukar escorts brought the two visitors to Shaddam's opulent cabin.